My mom was in the hospital with pneumonia. She was in the ICU for about 7 weeks. She couldn't communicate verbally, and she couldn't text, but she could communicate with me through simple hand squeezes and touches. And at that moment, I thought, why couldn't I just strip down a cell phone, get rid of the screen, and build a very simple device that she could put in the palm of her hand, and it would send a message to me, and I would know she's doing okay or she's not doing okay, or if I needed to come now.
Forget buttons or touchscreens. This week on Download This Show, we're going back to the Stone Age. No, literally, communicating with a computer with stones. Plus, what did the government have to compromise in order to potentially get their mandatory data retention scheme over the line? And how one porn website claimed to have harnessed the power of self-love to create energy. This is your guide to the week in technology, the internet and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and this is Download This Show. And it is a very big welcome to this week's panel. I don't know why I'm yelling so much. I'm just that excited about this week's show. He is the editor of Gizmodo Australia, Luke Hopewell.
Hello.
Welcome back.
There.
I feel like I'm saying it at the level that there should probably be like a studio audience.
Ta-da!
Yeah, you need like the canned clapping.
And the other voice you hear, she is a freelance technology journalist who writes for everyone. Claire Porter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And it looks like it's probably going to happen. The government have offered up wording that promises to protect journalists and sources from their planned mandatory data retention scheme, which of course would be the plan to keep your metadata for 2 years, though in this scenario it would only be accessible by warrant if you happen to be a journalist or journalist sources, theoretically. That is what it looks like the ALP will pass. What I'm curious about here, Luke Hopewell, is how do we determine what a journalist or a journalist source is? What's the structure of this, and what's the very specific language that they're using as well?
Well, according to Attorney General and Minister for Envelopes, George Brandis, the definition of a journalist is someone who is involved in the profession of journalism, which, you know, decode that however you like. Well, what's interesting is that ISPs will retain the data for 2 years as part of the legislation. If they want to access the metadata of a journalist, they are going to need a warrant. There's going to be a public advocate to argue against why there shouldn't be a warrant now, which is something that's been agreed to today. What you find is that this metadata can be used to connect you to a whole bunch of things. So despite the fact that nobody's really going to be looking at the content of the call or the content of a text message, you can tell by looking at a person who you don't need to get a warrant for if they've been calling a journalist or if they've been emailing a journalist. But to be perfectly honest, this has greater privacy implications as well. It's not just journalists who should be worried about this. It's everyone. It's a fundamental sort of erosion of privacy in my view.
Up until this week, Tony Abbott, George Brandis, Parliament in general, has been speaking in terms about mandatory data retention, that a warrant is going to be needed to access the data of anyone, but that still means that the data has to be stored in a database for up to 2 years. There hasn't been enough of an explicit statement where the journalists will be completely exempt from having their data stored in the first place. And the idea that they're now using this new amendment to act as though journalists are now safer than the rest of the country, you need a warrant to access anyone's metadata, but that doesn't mean that the government can't stop or force ISPs to build a database to store all of your information. And so I feel like it's being used to kind of blur the conditions and terms around the potential data scheme.
What we also find interesting here is, let's not forget, this is all part of a larger national security thing. So this is why George Brandis is very annoyed and saying it's not about journalism, it's not about journalists, it's about catching terrorists. Let's put that buzzword.
He has three. Yeah. It's terrorists, organized criminals, and pedophiles.
But
they're his greatest hits.
If it's not about journalists, why last year did you pass laws that could land any one of us in jail for 10 years for reporting on anything national security related?
Let's put that to one side for a second and say that now that we have this Public Interest Act advocate that's going to argue against issuing tick and flick warrants, like you want access to a metadata for a journalist, sure, let's go. And remember, at the start of this national security process, the first thing that George Brandis announced was a lowering of the threshold of proof to acquire a warrant for any state and federal policing agency, which means that they can act quicker on terrorist threats. So, you know, it's sort of like removing water from one glass and filling up another. It doesn't really help us much if it's easier to get a warrant, but we're saying we need a warrant. It's sort of double dutch, if you will.
And what does that say about the quality of investigations that are occurring? If you're watering down the burden of proof, data can say any number of things about any number of people. Mohammed Hanif, for example, was arrested on the grounds of being involved with terror groups based on a single thumbprint on a recycled mobile phone. That was before the burden of proof was lowered substantially by George Brandis. How many investigations are going to point in the wrong direction because they haven't done their research before acquiring a warrant?
The other issue here is, of course, who's going to pay for all this? And it seems this week that we are, in a way, that the different telecommunications companies have come out and said that they are, Luke, going to pass on the cost to us.
Absolutely. Everyone from the CEO of Telstra, Vodafone and Ironet down to rural ISPs have all signed on a letter sent by on behalf of the Communications Alliance to the government to say, hey, guys, tell us how much this is going to cost, because ISPs have not been sufficiently consulted enough to know in their business how much they're going to have to pay to accede to this data retention standard and how much of that they're going to have to pass on to their customers. Ever since this was minted in Parliament again, Ironet and a couple of other ISPs have actually warned that Australia is going to pay a quote-unquote internet surveillance tax because it is going to have to pass that money onto customers.
But the other thing here is that not that long ago, Tony Abbott came out and said it was going to cost the equivalent of $400 million. So what I'm curious here is that $400 million, I assume, is the amount the government will invest in it, but then there will also be an additional passed on cost to us by the telecommunications company, if I wrap my head around that correctly?
Yes, potentially, but again, there hasn't been enough explicit information about this for us to be able to say definitively whether that's the case. That $400 million is based on an estimate.
We should say at this point, though, that this particular piece of legislation, as it currently stands, is about to become bipartisan, though. This isn't just a Liberal Party issue. This is now a Labor Party issue as well, Luke.
Let's remember a very long time ago that the Attorney General, former Labor Attorney General Nicola Roxon, and then who succeeded her, Mark Dreyfus, after the spill, they both supported data retention. They had a plan to implement mandatory data retention for national security issues. The AFP has been championing it for a long time. It's been whispering in the ears of both sides. And that seems to be a great way to get a policy passed, is to label it as in the interest of national security. So let's remember, nobody really has their hands washed of this thing.
Clearly, the AFP have mounted a very successful argument to both houses of parliament. What was the pitch?
I can see the common sense behind the pitch, because obviously I would like to live in a quote-unquote buzzword alert safer Australia. And I think everyone would. Nobody wants to argue against that. The law enforcement pitch of this is, when a crime happens, it's really difficult for us to build a case against these sort of lone actors, simply because we don't know who they were talking to, we don't know what they were planning, and it's really hard to go and catch other people based on that. The pitch is, if we had access to their communications in a basket somewhere that we didn't know to look at before, we can actually go and get that, build a case against them, and then go and get other people who want to plan this in the future. The problem with that, and I think if you wanted to put a big stamp on it right now, even as it looks to pass the Houses of Representatives, is that you can put a stamp on it saying it's problematic. That's problematic simply because these are, by definition, lone actors. They are inspired by the actions of others, therefore don't communicate with many other people. And the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security has said that metadata retention wouldn't actually have helped stop things in, you know, the atrocities that went on in Martin Place and the things that went on with Charlie Hebdo in Paris, despite the fact that the government would like us to believe that. So, like I said, if you want to rubber stamp it at this point, it's problematic and needs more exposure and needs more public debate.
Not to mention, it assumes that criminals don't know how to use a VPN or hide their communications. And also, the bigger the haystack, the harder it is going to be to find a needle. No one is going to argue against targeted surveillance against known suspects or connections of known suspects. And I don't think anyone would argue against storing the information of known suspects and their connected network for a period of 2 years. That makes sense. But storing the rest of our information in the hopes that maybe, you know, 1-10% of those people might create some kind of anomalous blip because they've forgotten to hide themselves, it's a complete myth.
We are in studio with our panel this week. He is the editor of the tech website gizmodo.com.au, and Claire Porter is a freelance technology journalist. Mark Fennell is my name. And very big news in the last couple of weeks, I guess. $1.4 billion. That is how much money that TPG is expected to shell out to buy the ISP iiNet, which of course is currently embroiled in a lawsuit with the makers of Dallas Buyers Club, who would actually like the IP addresses of everybody that downloaded that, which is a sort of metadata that you might keep in a mandatory data retention scheme. There you go. There's a segue. Why buy now? I mean, if iiNet's embroiled in litigation, surely they're not that attractive to purchase.
Look, that's one arm of the company. That's their argumentative side coming out in the press. iiNet's always fought for its customers, but if you have a look at it from a fundamental business perspective, this couldn't be a smarter thing to do. TPG for a long time has been setting up scaffolds to build itself as a massive ISP conglomerate. You saw they bought a lot of wireless spectrum, which means they want to go and offer their own wireless products in the future. Wireless being mobile phone, pardon me. You also find that they're looking to buy iiNet to complement their existing fibre to the basement model. They're looking to compete with everyone. They're very tough.
Including the NBN.
Yeah, they're looking to compete with NBNco. They're looking to compete with Telstra and Optus. They're looking to play with the big boys. And this purchase of iiNet, they rationalised to their investors as adding a premium business tier to complement their existing low-cost, easy access tier.
This would make the final result the second largest telecommunications company in Australia, correct?
I believe so, yes.
All right. What does this do in terms of the two brands? Are they going to subsume iiNet into TPG? What's your gut feeling on that, Claire?
It would be really sad to see the iiNet brand disappear because it's been such a vocal opponent of things like mandatory data retention and of prosecuting pirates and of sending on the identities of customers to organisations like the MPAA, for example, which is the Motion Picture Association of America, who actually funded and powered its previous lawsuit against iiNet. I mean, what's going to happen to the Netflix deal? What's going to happen to the investor space? I mean, I expect to see iiNet have to move more into providing businesses with fiber and with bandwidth. And with that in mind, it will have to learn to keep its mouth shut publicly. So this acquisition probably comes at a perfect time because if iiNet were to be successful, it needs to appeal not only to the consumer market, but also to enterprise.
I don't think that they're going to retire the iiNet brand simply because they've spent a very long time building up this very friendly image as a premium internet service provider in Australia. They've always fought for their customers, and it is going to be interesting if they, you know, continue. They probably won't settle this lawsuit, but it would be interesting to see in future if they take up any others. That's their advocacy standpoint. But from a purely business perspective, I really strongly doubt that they'll retire the iiNet label. I strongly doubt that they'll retire the business practices of it either. Because iiNet's got a very successful fiber business. It's got a very successful negotiating arm. You mentioned with the Netflix deal, they're offering that unmetered. That's probably not going to go away. It's just bringing those capabilities in-house to TPG so that their good work can result in a good profit margin.
I was going to say, because there's certain things that they're things that TPG could learn from iiNet.
Having been a customer of both TPG and iiNet and of most of the major service providers in Australia, just for a bit of a laugh, because I have no life.
Wow. Exciting life of Luke Hopewell.
You wonder how it gives Moto editor lives. He goes around comparing ISP deals. TPG does have problematic customer service, and that's something that you notice from a low-cost ISP. They're fantastic 95% of the time, but the 5% of the time that something goes wrong and you need to call someone to even escalate it to level 2 customer service is very problematic. Now, we posted a story on gizmodo.com.au a little while ago saying these are the questions that need to be answered in the deal, and we got mixed results. People are saying, I had a great relationship with TPG when they needed to service me. I had a bad relationship with iiNet. And vice versa. It's bringing these capabilities back in-house so that the two can learn from each other and have a low-cost ISP and a premium-cost ISP both coming under the same balance sheet.
Let's not forget, though, that TPG has a tremendous challenge against it coming up in that it wants to circumvent the NBN in order to provide fibre to the basement to up to 5,000 homes in Sydney CBD. And then if that is successful, expand that to other areas within Australia. NBN is caught between a rock and a hard place. The entire point of having a national broadband network was to create competition where there was none. So having a second wholesaler is exactly the kind of result that you'd want to achieve. But unfortunately, it still needs to recoup between 46 and 60.2 billion dollars, which is the, you know, the cost of what it's going to take to roll the rest of the NBN out. So how do you create competition and recoup your investment at the same time without barring TPG from providing wholesale fiber to households around Australia?
The TPG's fibre to the basement deal is a very clever way of circumventing cherry-picking legislation to actually say, well, we're actually going to supply a competitive fibre product. And I may sound like a dirty capitalist for a moment, but I don't think there's anything wrong with competition.
Competition is the point. We haven't had any competition in Australia for the last 20, 30 years.
The National Broadband Network companies needed to get its acting gear about rolling out fibre faster to different places, and I don't really care how it does that in terms of which mode you prefer, whether it's fibre to the premises or fibre to the node or even fibre to the basement. By adding another strong fibre player and combining that with iiNet, which has strong NBN relationships, I think that TPG is onto something really, really great. And if it can stick the finger to the man in terms of regulatory competition, then I'm all for it.
Look, I mean, the problem is that Brandis and Turnbull have at one point or another suggested barring TPG from being able to do that in the first place, in which case all of this value proposition might be for nothing. So how does TPG expect to compete against a government-owned conglomerate?
We've done fibre, we've done legislation, we've done national security. It's time for porn.
Hooray!
Yes, an adult warning. If you do have children in the car, you may want to tune out for the next couple of minutes because we are about to create dirty energy, theoretically. That's the tagline for... Don't laugh at me. That is the tagline for a new product that is called... Wait for it. The Wank Band. It's created by a certain porn website, and the idea is that it'll use the kinetic energy generated from self-love to power a device. Walk me through it, Luke Hopewell.
So, as Download This Show's masturbatory correspondent...
God.
Thank God it's radio, is all I'm going to say.
Seriously, though, this band is interesting, but I think it's a bit of a stunt. Basically, what it does is it generates kinetic energy, puts it into a battery that you store on your wrist, that you recharge while self-abusing, and
were raised religious, weren't you?
Very. And you can plug that back into a device to provide power. Basically, it's a kinetic energy battery. Here's the problem with this. You're going to need to do a lot of masturbating to recharge a battery. Have you ever had one of those torches or radios that you've had to shake around to actually get power to? It takes a lot, and I don't know how long the usual reader goes for, but I don't think you're going to get a lot of battery life out of this thing.
There's an image I didn't need.
No, I mean, I tend to agree. I'm quite skeptical of this. I don't think that it is actually possible to generate a meaningful amount. Like, we know enough about kinetic energy that it's very hard to make enough of it for it to have any kind of meaningful... You know how I'm just going straight to the technology into this? Have any meaningful impact on charging, say, a phone or even a laptop, Claire?
I think this is just a really excellent PR exercise.
Which we have 100% bought into. I will say that we have not named the website, and I intend not to name the website it is based on.
Excellent.
Fantastic.
I expect the band will be received cheerfully by everyone, but I challenge anyone to actually use it to power anything. I reckon this can be successful before anyone does anything with it.
But what I find interesting about this is, though, it does speak to a broader area of alternative ways of powering our devices. Most of us that have smartphones often end up using them too much, and they die, particularly if you happen to be an Apple user. My phone dies by midday. Are there other technologies out there that are proven to be effective for charging your phone throughout the day? I'm thinking solar, and yes, that's right. I'm just pushing this as far away from the sex angle as I possibly can.
I was going to say, if you want to find a technology that for alternative energy that does not work at scale, it's masturbation. The interesting thing is there are a lot of ways to charge your phone and your gadgets these days. One of them is solar, and one of them is portable batteries and things like that. I think they've sort of missed the trick here. I think if you want to create a device that can be recharged really well with kinetic energy, have a smartwatch, because smartwatches are always running out of battery. It's always living on your wrist, and it's not something that needs to recharge and store energy kinetically. They only have tiny batteries. That'd be fine.
If you're listening, Tim Cook from Apple, Johnny Ive.
Hey, Tim.
This is what should be in the next
Apple
Watch.
Tiny batteries. I don't want to be the serious, sustainable person,
but
I'm going to go there.
I don't want to be this thing that I'm naturally born to be, but...
but let's just... We're at a point where various states and territories are considering the sell-off of the electricity grid under the claim that it is increasingly... the value of that asset is decreasing over time, and that electricity companies have for too long been allowed to gold-plate their infrastructure in order to charge higher prices. It's 2015. It's... about time we learn how to generate our own energy. It's ridiculous that we're paying thousands of dollars towards electricity companies. We have a carbon fiber bike that can charge your phone. We have portable batteries. There has been a solar battery sitting in a UNSW lab for 15 years and no company has purchased it because they realize that they can make more money charging electricity from a central grid than helping Australians create batteries that can store their own energy. I think it's about time that we figure out how we can do that and how the government can subsidise these.
Is there a portable charging device that either of you two use?
Yeah, I use a Lenovo portable charger for my phone, and it's great because it's a USB plug, and then it has all of the different plugs for various devices. So like old iPad, new iPad. I've got everything that I need in the one place. It's got a Bluetooth charger as well. I can charge all of my Chrome devices. It's fantastic.
There are a few different devices that, depending on what you actually use, will be good for you. Unfortunately, the portable laptop batteries, because laptop batteries actually chew through quite a bit of power, is still a bit of a pipe dream at this point. Mm. But if you want to charge a mobile device like a tablet, you've got cases from Mophie and OtterBox for all the major iOS and Android brands. You've also got one from Samsung, which is a very high-capacity battery. High-capacity batteries now are actually getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So, for example, if you want something that you can literally plug any USB cable into, say from a couple of different brands that you can buy from any major electronics retailer, you're probably only going to pay, you know, up to $150 for that. And that's something that can get you out of a pinch really quickly. I know there's one in my bag right now.
Download This Show is what you're listening to. Finally here in the show, possibly one of the stranger things we've done on this show here with Luke Hopewell, Claire Porter and Mark Fennell. The world today is very dependent on verbal and visual communication. So, you know, there's things like Siri, sure, but most of us interact with our computers via something visual, a screen, a touch screen perhaps even. But what happens if you're not necessarily capable of engaging that way? Well, there is something called smart stones.
This is the first of its kind touch communication device. We're creating the world's first language of nonverbal communication that allows people to communicate through simple taps, swipes, and gestures. And it's a stone. It literally is a completely sealed unit. It's packed full of sensor technology that allows you to detect motion gestures, multi-touch, taps, swipes.
A fascinating concept. Walk me through it, Claire Porter. Exactly how does it go?
It's designed for nonverbal communication. Its creator invented the device after his mother got ill. She was not able to communicate either physically or verbally, and she was in hospital for a long period of time, and he wanted to know her movements but knew that he couldn't sit on speakerphone to her all day. So he actually created this smart stone, which allows you to communicate.
It looks like a pebble, doesn't it?
Yeah, like a tiny little pebble.
Like a stream, like a rock you'd pull out of a stream.
Yeah, the sort of thing that you would, you know, you'd flick across the water. It's about the
Don't do that, it's expensive.
Very expensive. About the distance between your index finger and your thumb.
Yeah.
They're kind of flat.
And you can swipe over it in different ways to send communications to your friends or loved ones to let them know where you are, what you've been doing. For example, you know, say your, God forbid, ill mother or grandmother is got a physio appointment and you want to make sure that she's made it back to her home okay, rather than having to like search through the bag and figure out how to use a mobile phone, which when you're elderly or ill isn't necessarily your first instinct, you simply just swipe over the stone and it'll send your loved one saying, back from physio, I'm okay. So you program the stone to send different communications, and you would have to learn what swipes and what movements send different communications.
So it's very specific gestures on the stone that's reading?
The gestures are specific, and then it also like beeps and vibrates. We're using different colours, and those different the order that the colours are shown in or the way that it vibrates will indicate a particular form of communication.
Isn't that kind of something you could do with a phone in any way? Like even if you took away the visual component of the phone?
Absolutely. And also you have to program the stone, which like requires a techie second or third party. This device is designed for people whose communication skills are not up to scratch. Young children, the elderly, perhaps, you know, the mentally infirm. This is something for whom physical and verbal communication are a struggle. So you need someone else who's like abled and techie to set it up. And that kind of does defeat the easy purpose of it somewhat.
I'll admit that when I saw this, it set off my inner Stargate nerd. And if anyone else is out there who is feeling that right now,
holla.
Represent, holla.
Which part of, sorry, which part of Stargate does it represent?
Oh, don't make me say
it. Yeah, why not? Yeah.
So
we're
basically,
not friends anymore.
Oh, here we go. Wow.
If you come in and admit to something embarrassing, I will ask.
It's
last
not
week,
embarrassing.
Last week we had Ben Grubb talking about his Sea Monkey watch. This week it'll be Luke Hopewell and his
ancient
Stargate
society
addiction.
Who invented these communication stones that if you put it on a certain reader and another person has it on a reader, you guys can swap bodies. So I'm just like, it's ancient communication stones on Kickstarter. I want one.
Just so we're clear, that's you have to get an extension for it to do the body swap
yes.
technology.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, it's a plugin, and that plugin's like $900 million.
Right.
I know all about Stargate, ladies.
Heyo.
Basically, what's really interesting about this is that they've been working on it for about a year. You can see in their sort of crowdfunding story, but they're about to have their lunch cut in a pretty big way by the Apple Watch, which actually has this non-verbal communication aspect as one of their selling points. You know, you can pair with another person who has an Apple Watch and double tap. Obviously, it's not as simple as the smart stones, but you can double tap to tell someone that you're thinking of them, or you can have a pre-registered message go up that you can send straight from your watch. There are a couple of different other technologies that also do it from other manufacturers. So it's going to be interesting to see that if this technology is already integrated into something that people are going to buy, why would they get it in a separate device?
I know I just criticized it for being a little bit ineffective, but I do think it's a really novel strategy. You know, particularly for children who are suffering from autism or Asperger's, for example, or like I said, for people who have mental illness and who may not be able to immediately communicate that they're in distress, I think it's fantastic that you can wear quite lovely, like this little pebble around your neck.
Nice.
And you can just swipe to your parents to say, I need help, or I'm being bullied, or I've hurt myself, or I've fallen over. It's the equivalent of like an EpiPen or like an emergency button that you see a lot of old people who live alone wearing. I think insofar as like child safety and like the safety of people who are excluded from the greater community, I actually think this device is targeted really nicely. And I think the guy who created it, his heart is absolutely in the right place. And I do think we are going to see situations where this stone maybe could save someone's life. Or if it meant that, you know, you could get to your kid 5 minutes quicker than if she were taken to the nurse's room and then to the principal, and then the principal has to call your parents. It allows that direct interaction, and it's private. So you don't have to run off and make a phone call. You can seemingly look fine and just tap it quietly if you're in distress. That could be really effective, particularly if you've got a child with a communication problem.
They've missed a mark on the marketing as well. It's get stoned and save a life.
Download this show. Has been the name of the show. You can address your complaints to hopewell.lukenad. Very big thank you to Luke
Hopewell on Twitter. Come complain at me.
Luke Hopewell, Claire Porter, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
If you would use the smart stones, what would you use it for? Let us know on Twitter. The hashtag is DownloadThisShow. Very keen to know if you have an inventive use of them. My name has been Mark Fennell. Thank you so much for listening to another episode. We'll catch you next week. Goodbye.